Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 25th anniversary. That's a quarter of a century of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear anywhere else. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now to make your contribution and help us stay on the air for at least another 25 years. Thank you so much. Oh, and remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Dozens of people who were injured from the bomb here and the bullets. It's amazing. This is a praying place, not for a fight.
Over 300 Palestinians have been injured after Israeli security forces attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque today with rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and sound bombs. This comes as Palestinians continue to protest Israeli efforts to evict dozens of Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem to give their homes to Jewish settlers.
It's easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yanni.
We'll speak to a Palestinian poet who's organizing to save his family's home in Sheikh Jarrah. Then to Afghanistan. At least 85 people have died, mostly schoolgirls, after an attack outside their school Saturday.
The school time was over and we were coming out when a car exploded in front of us.
We'll go to Kabul for the latest. Then we speak to Ari Berman on the latest Republican attacks on voting rights.
All across the country, in states like Texas and Florida, Republicans are weaponizing and institutionalizing Trump's big lie that the election was stolen in order to make it harder for Democratic constituencies to be able to vote.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our audience, our top stories contain graphic images of violence. Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem this morning amidst mounting violence in recent days. Soldiers deployed rubber bullets, tear gas, sound bombs at Palestinians, injuring hundreds. Over the weekend, Israeli forces wounded hundreds more worshippers and protesters at Al-Aqsa, including on one of the holiest nights of Ramadan. Protests have been growing against the expulsion of Palestinian families from Sheikh Jarrah, a neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem.
The plan is to occupy all of Jerusalem and turn it into a Jewish ethnic developing city that lacks an Arab presence. And this allows them to occupy the Palestinian capital, and this allows them to get all the homes, like they did in Nakba in 1948 and in 1967.
On Sunday, Israel's Supreme Court postponed a hearing set for today on the planned evictions from Sheikh Jarrah. The court will schedule a new date within 30 days. Meanwhile, the nationalist Israeli holiday, Jerusalem Day, and its annual flag march is going ahead today, prompting fears of further violence. We'll have more on this after headlines with the writer and poet Mohammed El-Kurd, who's organizing to save his family's home in Sheikh Jarrah. In Afghanistan, at least 85 people, mostly schoolgirls, were killed after several bombs exploded outside a school in the capital, Kabul, Saturday. Devastated families buried their loved ones amidst mounting despair and anger.
Our message to the government is that they should ensure our peace and security. Also, our message to the blind-hearted enemy is that there are so many incidents in Kabul. They should stop the violence and accept peace and stability. Until when will we bury the dead bodies? Our government officials only apologized and showed sympathy, which doesn't cure our pain.
The blasts occurred in a neighborhood mostly populated by the minority Hazara Shia community. The Afghan government blamed the Taliban, though the group denied responsibility. The massacre came 1 week after U.S. and NATO forces began their military withdrawal from Afghanistan and as violent attacks are surging. Elsewhere in the country, at least 11 people were killed and dozens, including women and children, were injured in a bus bombing in southern Zabul province late Sunday. We'll have more from Afghanistan later in the broadcast. India's government faces growing calls for a nationwide lockdown as its health ministry reported 366,000 new coronavirus infections and nearly 3,800 deaths today. Those figures are down only slightly from world records set by India last week and fail to account for widespread underreporting. Health officials say recent super spreader events have combined with a more transmissible coronavirus variant to drive a massive surge in cases.
So this new mutant strain has high infectivity compared to last time. So more than 5 times the number of people are getting affected in the second wave. That's the specialty of these two strains, the UK strain and the Maharashtra strain.
The World Health Organization warns India's driving surges elsewhere in Asia, with cases rising in Nepal, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, Indonesia, and elsewhere. In Pakistan, officials have ordered a 9-day partial lockdown ahead of the Eid holiday marking the end of the Muslim month of Ramadan. Tunisia has begun a week of coronavirus restrictions, including during the Eid holiday, with the prime minister warning Tunisia faces the worst health crisis in its history. Meanwhile, Brazil's official COVID-19 caseload has topped 15 million, the third highest in the world, after India and the United States. Infectious disease experts say far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is largely to blame for the pandemic's devastating toll.
Tudo isso em função de uma política.
All of this COVID pandemic is down to a disastrous policy from the federal government of an anti-scientific policy of denial.
In vaccine news, the World Health Organization approved China's Sinopharm's vaccine for emergency use Friday. This is WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
This expands the list of vaccines that COVAX can buy and gives countries confidence to expedite their own regulatory approval and to import and administer a vaccine.
Sinopharm is the sixth vaccine to receive emergency use approval by the WHO. Here in the United States, Pfizer is requesting full approval from the Food and Drug Administration for its vaccine for people 16 and older. All three COVID vaccines currently in use in the United States have emergency use authorization. If successful, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine would be the first to be fully approved. In Iraq, unidentified gunmen on motorbikes assassinated prominent journalist and anti-corruption activist Ehab Al-Wazni near his home in the city of Karbala early Monday. His killing follows the murders and kidnappings of dozens of other activists who joined an October 2019 anti-government uprising to demand jobs, better services, and an end to corruption. Hundreds of people were killed during those protests. Local activists blame armed militias backed by Iran for the continuing violence, and protests have erupted in Karbala. This is a journalist speaking from Awazni's funeral Sunday.
This killing operation can happen to any civil society activist. At any time, we could see a friend or a colleague or any protester or civil society activist be killed easily in his bloodshed, and the government does not do anything. Why hasn't it disclosed who killed the protesters?
Back in the United States, a gunman shot and killed 6 people at a birthday party in Colorado Springs Sunday. The gunman, who was reportedly in a relationship with one of the female victims, also shot and killed himself. There were children present, but none of them were killed or injured. The Colorado massacre comes after a rash of gun violence Saturday. In Baltimore, 4 people, including the gunman, were killed during a shooting and 2 alarm fire. In New York City's Times Square, 2 women and a 4-year-old girl were injured after a shooting. And in South Florida, 3 people were wounded by gunfire in a shopping mall Saturday. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been nearly 200 mass shootings since the beginning of the year. In related news, the Justice Department proposed a new rule Friday to crack down on so-called ghost guns, home-assembled, unregulated firearms that account for about a third of guns recovered at crime scenes. The rule says retailers would have to run background checks before selling ghost gun kits, and components would need to include serial numbers. 3D-printed guns would also need to start carrying serial numbers. The Justice Department has filed federal criminal charges against Derek Chauvin and three other former Minneapolis police officers involved in the murder of George Floyd last May. The indictment charges Chauvin, who was convicted of murdering Floyd, of using unreasonable force. The three others, Thomas Lane, Alexander King, and Toe Tao, are accused of failing to provide Floyd with medical care, and two of the men with failing to intervene and stop Chauvin from killing Floyd. The three former officers are also still facing state charges of aiding and abetting the murder and manslaughter of George Floyd. In a separate case, former police officer Derek Chauvin also faces a federal indictment for violating the civil rights of a 14-year-old boy from Minneapolis, whom he grabbed by the throat, hit multiple times with a flashlight, and whose neck he kneeled on during a 2017 arrest. In North Carolina, a judge ruled the family of Andrew Brown Jr. will only be allowed to see a fraction of the body camera footage of his killing. Brown was a 42-year-old black father who was shot five times by police officers last month, including a fatal shot to the back of the head. The family, which has so far only seen 20 seconds of body cam video, will be shown less than 20 minutes of the 2 hours of tape that was recorded. The footage will not be available to the public. Faith leaders, loved ones, community members marched in Elizabeth City Saturday to demand transparency and justice for Andrew Brown. This is his aunt, Lily Brown Clark.
We need to see the body cams. 20 seconds. Not enough.
Not enough.
20 minutes.
Not enough.
Not enough. We want to see the whole tape. Stop snipping and showing us what you want to show us.
The Colonial Pipeline Company halted shipments of fuel across the eastern United States over the weekend after suffering what executives said was a ransomware attack Friday. The cyber attack idled a pipeline network that transports nearly half the East Coast fuel supply from Texas to New Jersey. In response, the Biden administration enacted emergency powers, lifting limits on the transport of fuels by road to compensate for any shortages. U.S. officials blame the criminal gang DarkSide, which mostly operates out of Russia. It was the Colonial Pipeline Company's worst crisis since last summer, when a pipeline rupture in North Carolina spilled at least 1.2 million gallons of gasoline, the largest spill in the state's history. And Senator Bernie Sanders, Congressmember Ilhan Omar, and other Democratic lawmakers have introduced a bill to make all school meals free for every student. Congressmember Omar noted three-quarters of school districts have school meal debt, and the new bill would, quote, eliminate school meal debt and strengthen local economies by incentivizing local food procurement. Some 13 million children in the U.S. live in food-insecure homes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of Palestinians have been wounded after Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque this morning for the second time in 4 days. Al Jazeera reports Israelis fired rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and sound bombs at Palestinian worshippers. Video posted online shows explosives, possibly stun grenades, being fired inside the mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam. A warning to our audience, this segment contains disturbing video. Al Jazeera reports medical personnel were initially barred from reaching the injured Palestinians. Eyewitnesses described a scene of terror when Israeli forces began opening fire while people prayed.
We were praying in the mosque. Suddenly, the soldiers located the mosque without any alert. They started to shoot the bombs, and there are many, dozens of injured, dozens of people who were injured from the bombs here and the bullets. It's amazing. This is a praying place, not for a fight.
Al Jazeera reports 305 Palestinians were wounded, 228 have been hospitalized, with 7 in critical condition. Israeli forces also attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday, on a night when at least 205 Palestinians were injured. Today's raid came hours before Israeli nationalists were scheduled to begin an annual march through occupied East Jerusalem to mark Israel's 1967 capture of the area along with the West Bank and Gaza. Tension has been escalating in Jerusalem for weeks. On April 22nd, a group of right-wing Israelis marched through the old city, chanting death to Arabs and may your village burn. Video from the night shows Israeli mobs attacking and harassing Palestinian families and throwing rocks at Palestinian buses and homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been staging weeks of protests to block Israel from evicting dozens of Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem to give their homes to Jewish settlers. A court hearing on the eviction scheduled for today was postponed Sunday. The United Nations has described the planned eviction as a possible war crime. UN Rights Office spokesman Rupert Colville said last week, quote, "The occupying power cannot confiscate private property in occupied territory." This comes as the Biden administration is coming under increasing pressure to directly condemn Israel's actions. Last week, the governments of France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Britain issued a joint call for Israel to stop all settlement expansion in the occupied territories. We go now to Jerusalem, where we're joined by Mohammed El-Kurd, a Palestinian writer and poet who's organizing to save his family's home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem. First, give us the overall picture, Mohammed, of what has been happening. Describe what's been happening at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and all around the area, and then we'll talk about Al Jarrah, Sheikh Jarrah.
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, thank you, Amy, and it's a pleasure to be here with you. To sum up what's been happening in Al-Aqsa Mosque, it's complete state settler collusion. It's clearly that the Israeli occupation forces are working in service of the Israeli settlers to terrorize and assault Palestinian worshippers in their mosque. Today, Palestinians have been met with rubber-coated bullets in the face and in the upper body, tear gas inside the mosque at the women and the children praying in there, in addition to many other forms of brute force. The same thing is in Sheikh Jarrah, and this image becomes even more stark when compared by how the Israeli occupation forces are treating the settlers. Today, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian youth, and instead of being captured, the Israeli police raised his gun at Palestinians who are protesting this act of terrorism. So we're seeing clear state settler violence and clear state settler collusion in Jerusalem, in occupied Jerusalem.
And we're just about to see this next march. Can you explain what, quote, Jerusalem Day is and the significance of this mass march?
Definitely. It's an infamous march that I've witnessed every single year of my life, whereby Israeli settlers come from all over occupied historic Palestine and chant genocidal, racist chants against Palestinians. They destroy Palestinian property. One time, a few years ago, I came home from school and I found a settler sitting on my couch. This is the extent by which they behave, because they know they have impunity, because they knew they are going to suffer zero consequences from their state, who is a fascistic state to begin with.
How old are you, Mohammed?
I'm 22 years old.
So I want to go to a video that's gone viral on social media. It shows your twin 22-year-old sister, Muna El-Kurd, confronting an Israeli settler who's been living in a part of your house in Sheikh Jarrah for 12 years.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this. I didn't do this.
But
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yaammi.
Can you explain this scene and talk more specifically about what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah right now?
Absolutely. The scene that you saw, Amy, is a scene of colonialism. People often think that colonialism is this archaic concept or a concept of recent memory, but in fact, it's alive and well in Palestine. And this is a colonizer that happens to be from Brooklyn, as you can hear by the accent, who decided to find home in my backyard. This happens because we, as a community of refugees in Sheikh Jarrah, have been battling billionaire-backed, often U.S.-registered settler organizations that employ these people to come and live in our homes and harass us and intimidate us. These people are not employed. These people are not families. They just come to terrorize us. Yesterday, our next door neighbor, Hajesh family, his roof was invaded by settlers wielding stones, bags and bags of stones. What's happening in Sheikh Jarrah today is nothing short of ethnic cleansing. To help the people
understand, I mean, this man who is in your yard, this guy you said who's from Brooklyn, explain how this, your family, your house got half occupied in 2009. You're living with them?
Yeah, I mean, yes, in 2009, we were coming home from school and we found that the entire neighborhood was on lockdown. It was besieged from all areas. And there were more occupation forces and settlers than there were residents of the neighborhood. And they used tear gas and sound bombs and stun grenades to take over our home. And these settlers, these thieves have squatted in our home since then. And obviously, you cannot resist this. Or otherwise you will be shot and killed. We know how the Israeli occupation forces behave around Palestinians. We know how they target Palestinians. But I wanted to add that this is just a microcosm. You know, I know it sounds bizarre that an Israeli settler is taking over half of my home, and likely they will be taking over the entirety of the neighborhood should no international action be taken. But it's not as absurd when you put it in context of how the state of Israel came about. It came about by destroying and burning hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian cities and villages and taking over Palestinians' homes. Today, all over historic Palestine, there are settlers who are living in homes that were once Palestinian.
In response to the violent crackdown of Palestinian protesters in Jerusalem, Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, whose parents are Palestinian immigrants, tweeted this weekend, "Too many are silent or dismissive of our U.S. tax dollars continue to be used for this kind of inhumanity. I'm tired of people functioning from a place of fear rather than doing what's right because of the bullying by pro-Israel lobbyists. This is apartheid, plain and simple." Meanwhile, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted Saturday, "We stand in solidarity with the Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem. Israeli forces are forcing families from their homes during Ramadan and inflicting violence. It's inhumane, and the U.S. must show leadership in safeguarding the human rights of Palestinians." She also condemned U.S. aid to Israeli forces and other repressive governments around the world, tweeting, "From the paramilitary violence in Colombia and Sheikh Jarrah to the detention children of children on our own border and the militarization of U.S. police departments, the U.S. must seriously assess its role in state violence and condition aid." So talk about this place that is your home, your family's home. This is a flashpoint for so much of what's happening, as you said, a microcosm. Explain what the judge's ruling has been. Court was supposed to go into session today, but they've canceled the hearing because of the level of violence right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we think that this is a stalling on the Israeli judicial system's part. I want to make it clear to all people watching that although we go to these courts, we do not believe in their jurisdiction over us. We are simply buying time in our homes. At the end of the day, these are colonial courts. These are courts that were built by and for Israeli settlers to uphold Jewish supremacy. And the Israeli authorities are unabashed and explicit in maintaining this Jewish dominance in Jerusalem over the indigenous Palestinians. We are waiting, but we are not expecting much of a settler judge and a settler jury, to be completely honest with you. I am glad on a congressional level, people are speaking out against this, and on a grassroots level internationally, people are speaking out against this. Every single year, Israel receives $3.8 billion in military aid. Biden has been consistent in refusing the idea of conditioning military aid to Israel. I don't want him to condition it. I want him to end it altogether, and I want him to end any kind of military aid to any country that has a police brutality problem like Colombia. But obviously, this necessitates the United States acknowledging that it has an imperialism problem to begin with. So we do call on the Biden administration to take action against the evictions that are a war crime. But I also will not forget that my home, half of my home and my neighbor's home, Ghawi and Hanun families, were taken under the Obama administration with Biden as a vice president.
So let's talk about what the Biden administration has said. You have the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, saying the United States has serious concerns about the violent clashes between Palestinians and Jerusalem. He told Israeli National Security Advisor Meir Ben-Shabbat, U.S. officials will press for steps to ensure calm, de-escalate tensions, and denounce violence, adding that the launching of rocket attacks from Gaza towards Israel is unacceptable and must be condemned. That, again, the Israeli National Security Advisor. If you can respond to this, so he has expressed, quote, serious concerns. Last week, the governments of France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Britain issued a joint call for Israel to stop all settlement expansion in the occupied territories.
We welcome all of the international condemnations that we are seeing from countries, be it the United States or otherwise, but we want more than just condemnations. We want Israel to be held accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. The Biden administration and the language of a false equivalency continue to uphold this occupation. I think you can de-escalate the situation and the tension and the violence in Jerusalem by ending the occupation. That is the only solution. It is insane for Palestinians to continue living under this occupation for 73 years. What's the situation in Jerusalem isn't that there's a Palestinian Authority and other Palestinian parties involved. There's Palestinian people, grassroots individuals without any kind of leadership who are finally saying no and continually saying no to ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem and otherwise. And there's an occupier, an occupying entity that is using brute force and fascism and apartheid to suppress any kind of peaceful protest or any kind of protest altogether. In the past 2 weeks, our neighbors' homes and our own homes have been sprayed with skunk water that I can smell them from a few blocks. We've had so much stun grenades and tear gas. My own brother, not that he's different from other people, but my own brother has been arrested. Many, many people have been arrested. A person lost his eyes in Al-Aqsa Mosque. We are seeing the Israeli government terrorizing Palestinians. We are seeing the Israeli government literally doing everything it can to terrorize Palestinians, whereas Israeli settlers can just walk around our neighborhoods, steal our homes, and wield their guns. No questions asked whatsoever. They can invade our homes and be told all is good by a police officer, and they can just go back. No consequences. There's clear asymmetry here. I think apartheid is an understatement, but it's a good starting point. This settler colonialism in Palestine must stop because it's killing all of us.
Human Rights Watch using that term apartheid to describe what's happening in the occupied territories for the first time last month. I want to turn to a Palestinian man named Mahmoud al-Marbua, who witnessed the Israeli assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque Saturday.
They don't want us to pray. There's a fight every day. Every day there are clashes. Every day there are troubles. They've been stopping us from entering inside the old city for a whole week. Why? They didn't allow us in yesterday. Why? Why are they doing this to us? They're making us crazy. They make us explode. Look at how they're firing at us. How can we live? Is this the normal life? What is this? Look at the problems. Look at how they're standing around. They're throwing bombs at us and they can't see anyone.
So, Mohammed, as we begin to wrap up now, you live between here and Sheikh Jarrah, where you went back to with all that is happening there and to protect your family home. Can you talk about what you see happening? I mean, is it conceivable by the end of the week, the Israeli prime minister, who himself has been indicted for corruption, Benjamin Netanyahu, might not even be the prime minister anymore? And does that even make a difference with who is the leadership in the Israeli government?
I think as long the leadership is spearheaded by settlers, then settlements will prevail in our countries. I do not want to be living under Israeli rule to begin with, and I don't rely on the Israeli authorities, on the Israeli occupation forces to protect me. Although they are mandated to do so under international law, I think it's pointless for us to expect a person who is beating us up, assaulting us, terrorizing us, to be told to stop and then have them stop. There must be international intervention. There must be sanctions against the Israeli government. That is the only way the occupation must end. And it's also important to note that what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah is not new, and it's not unique, and it hasn't started or ended with an Israeli prime minister. It's happening in Silwan, where 100 homes are being demolished and 1,000 people will be homeless. It's happening in the South Hebron Hills, where people's villages are being declared as military zones and green zones. It's happening all across historic Palestine. It's the Israeli colonialism that started in 1948, and it continues to do so. The only difference is it replaced weapons and artillery with a judicial system that is inherently colonial. So I call on the international community, but also I call on people, free people in the world, to take action against this, to end Israeli occupation of Palestine altogether. It's not just about Sheikh Jarrah. It's about the entirety of Palestine that is being devoured by the beast of Israeli colonialism.
Mohammed El-Kurd, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Writer and poet from Jerusalem and occupied Palestine, organizing to save his family's home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem. His debut book, Rivka, will be released by Haymarket Books later this year. Next up, we go to Afghanistan, where at least 85 people, mainly schoolgirls, have died in an attack outside their school. We'll go to Kabul for the latest.
للصدى توق إلى حضن التلال للندى لون احتضار كالغروب لليالي سرها يكسو وساها للندامة خمرهم مالي سواها للأسى بيت كجسم مطمئن في أخفي ما بدا للناس مني منا
Music by Camelia Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. You can sign up for our daily news digest by emailing the word Democracy Now! Without a space, Democracy Now!. Text that word to 66866 today, and you'll get our news alerts and daily headlines. This is Democracy Now! As we go to Afghanistan, at least 85 people, mostly young girls, were killed after several bombs exploded outside a school in the capital, Kabul, Saturday. Survivors said the bombs were timed to go off as the girls left their classrooms.
The school time was over and we were coming out when a car exploded in front of us.
Devastated families buried their loved ones amidst mounting despair and anger.
She was 15 years old and in eighth grade. She was very intelligent and didn't miss a single day of school. Yesterday, her mother told her not to go to school, but she said, "No, mother, I will go today, but not go tomorrow." She told the truth, and we buried her today.
The blasts occurred in a neighborhood of Kabul, mostly populated by the minority Hazara Shia community. The Afghan government blamed the Taliban, but the group denied responsibility. The massacre came 1 week after U.S. and NATO forces began their military withdrawal from Afghanistan and amidst a surge in violence. Elsewhere in the country, at least 11 people were killed Dozens, including women and children, were injured in a bus bombing in southern Zabulcom province late Sunday. Meanwhile, a new report has found 40% of all civilian casualties from airstrikes in Afghanistan in the last 5 years were children. The organization Action on Armed Violence estimates U.S. and Afghan airstrikes have killed 785 children and injured 813 since 2016. We go first to Kabul, Afghanistan, where we're joined by Basir Bitah, a mentor with Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. His brother is a teacher who survived the bombing outside his school Saturday. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe what happened and tell us about the girls?
Down and was working.
Basir, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Ah, okay. Can you tell us about what happened this weekend? Describe the school for girls in Kabul. The death toll is just staggering at least 85 right now.
Yes. It happened yesterday, 2 days ago in the afternoon. I was shocked when I heard the story. I quickly tried to reach to my brother over phone, and he didn't pick up when I reached him three times. And I was super shocked. And after a while, I managed to reach to my brother, and he would say, I'm shocked. He couldn't speak. His colleagues told me that he couldn't speak for 1 hour or two because he was totally shocked. And yesterday, my wife and I went to the very place that the incident took place. And all I saw was that people, mothers, sisters, brothers, just weeping out, crying. This is the story of the incident.
We're having a little trouble hearing you. We're going to try to clear up that line. We're also on with Zahir Wahab, who's an Afghan-American professor who taught for 4 decades at Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education and for 7 years at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul, goes back and forth between Afghanistan and the United States. Professor Wahab, thanks for rejoining us. You're a professor of education. just if you can talk about this school, it is horrifying to say this target and what this means and what the girls were doing at this school.
Yes. Good morning, Amy, and thank you for having me. And I want to commend you for your wonderful journalism. This was actually not the first time that a school had been attacked. The school is located in what is called Barshi, which is in the western part of Kabul, sort of in the suburbs. And this is mainly populated by the Hazara population, which constitute about a third of the Afghan population, and all of them being Shiites. This particular school was a mixed school, and apparently it operates actually 3 shifts per day for boys and for girls, and it's a high school. It's called the Shuhada High School. And the explosion occurred. The car apparently was parked at 1 p.m. And when the students were out at 4:30 p.m., somehow word got around that there's a charity organization in front or near at the gate of the school distributing some goods and so forth. And so most of the girls, hundreds of girls, gathered around at the entrance. And at that point, the car bomb in a Toyota, which was packed with explosives, apparently. The car explodes, and then in a few minutes, there were 2 subsequent explosions via IED, improvised explosion devices. So this is what happened. And then, of course, you know, you said that some 83 girls were killed and more than 150 were injured. And apparently, the explosion was so strong that some of the students completely evaporated. They disappeared. They couldn't be found. And then, other than that, you know, people were maimed and dismembered. You know, you found heads without bodies and bodies without heads, limbs and so forth. And then the people rushed, and apparently this was a mile and a kilometer from a police station, and it took the police station about an hour to respond to the explosion. So people were very, very angry when the police and ambulances arrived. Some of the people actually began attacking the police and the ambulances and talked, you know, to sort of curse the government and blame the government for its indifference and lack of attention to the security of the school. But as I said, this was at least the third time that a mass murder had occurred in this very same area, which is populated by Hazaras and poor Hazaras. You know, there was an attack exactly a year ago by a maternity hospital, killing a lot of people. And then there was an attack on a judo club where a lot of people were killed. And then there was an attack in the last year on a main tutoring center where a lot of students were killed. But we should also point out that just in the last few months, there was a major attack on Kabul University in the city itself, in the capital, on the law school, which killed at least 24 students. And then on April 1st, there was an attack, a car bomb attack on high school graduates who had gathered in Logar province, which is not very far from Kabul, and they were getting ready to take the entrance examination. So such mass murders or mass massacres are sort of the usual thing in Afghanistan, unfortunately, other than the you know, targeted assassinations all over the country. Of judges, lawyers, professors, journalists, civil society people, and also the war that is currently raging in 13 states. So I will stop there. But also I want to point out that one glimmer of hope seems to be that just last night, both the Taliban and the government announced a three-day ceasefire to take place during the Eid al-Fitr.
One of the early justifications, Professor, for the invasion of Afghanistan was protecting women and girls from Taliban misogyny. I remember Laura Bush would often come out to talk about this. You're highly critical of this pretext. What is your message to those who say now, see, the U.S. has to stay in Afghanistan once again to protect girls?
I think this is sort of a wrong, and it's not really exactly true, because if you look at the statistics in the last 20 years, a lot of women and a lot of children, as you pointed out, have been killed. But also, right now, there's no safety or security anywhere. I mean, it's very interesting to read the United States State Department advisory, you know, which advises Americans to leave Afghanistan, but also advises Americans and others to not to go to Afghanistan. And the advisory lists, you know, specifically all kinds of places, schools, universities, clubs, restaurants, mosques, you know, sports events, etc., that these are all over the country unsafe, and that people should not go to Afghanistan. But also, you know, we should remember that the initial assault on October 7, 2001, by the United States was really a retaliation. You know, it wasn't a planned action or invasion or occupation, I should say, but it was simply a reflexive response to the crime of 9/11. So later, of course, you know, the American government had to have these justifications in the liberation of so-called liberation of women. Was one thing. But we have to point out that women and children continue to be the main victims of this occupation and invasion and the mayhem. If you look at, for example, 85% of the women in the country are still illiterate. Child marriage is very common. Polygamy is very common. And poverty amongst women is very, very common. And altogether, 70% of the people are poor. So whether it was the so-called liberation of women or ending the narcotics, or bringing peace, prosperity, and democracy to Afghanistan, all of these were, I think, sort of for television, for the American audience, because the facts on the ground are entirely different. And it is very questionable, and it's being said by observers, what happened to the $135 billion aid package by the United States, and where is the development? Because, right now, most people, women in particular, live in the Middle Ages. You know, they're poor, they're widowed, they're, brutalized. And it's not really true. Although a few women, we should point out, a few women in the major cities are going to school and to the universities and have government jobs and travel. But for most women, like most Afghans, people live in pain and suffering.
I want to see if we can, if we have a clearer line with Basir Bita, again, mentor with Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, your brother just barely surviving this attack on the girls' school in Kabul. The Taliban have not claimed responsibility, though they have been blamed for this. Who do you think is responsible, and overall, the significance of the U.S. leaving?
You know, there are different stories. Like, I'm hearing different stories from different sources saying that some claim that ISIS or Taliban are responsible for the incidents, but some other people claim that the responsibility goes to the central government. Because, you know, almost 2 or 3 weeks ago, I remember clearly that the same school that the incident took place, along with one or two other schools in the area, the students and the teachers and the school administrators ran onto the streets and shouting out that we need more resources. We need textbooks. We need teachers. They lack facilities, educational facilities. And you would see that within 3 or 2 weeks, such a big incident takes place on the very school that whose students and teachers rallied on the streets. And it's unclear that who is responsible for this incident.
Human Rights Watch has put out a statement warning that groups should not be abandoning support, financial support for women, warning Afghan women's access to health care is at risk due to cuts in international aid. The group said, quote, donors are locked in a waiting game to see whether the withdrawal of foreign troops will result in the Taliban gaining greater control of the country. But this is no excuse for cutting funds for essential services that aid groups have managed to deliver in insecure and Taliban-controlled areas. So often, these nonprofits will link up with the military. And when a military leaves, the nonprofits also leave. They find it harder to get funding. Your final comment, Basir Bita.
I think that this is a vicious circle that has been played since the U.S. invasion in 2001. How long are we going to need for the U.S. involvement financially, economically, politically, and militarily in Afghanistan? There was no development plan. There was no clear action plan for Afghanistan when the U.S. planned to invade the Afghanistan. And it is still, I believe that the final solution would be the involvement of Afghan people, Afghan government, civil society organization and activists, along with the Taliban and other insurgents groups, to come up with a very clear, useful, and applicable plan for the future of Afghanistan.
Bashir Bitha, I want to thank you for being with us, mentor with Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. His brother's a teacher at the high school in Kabul, Afghanistan, who survived Saturday's attack. Thank you for joining us from Afghanistan. He visited the site over the weekend. And Zahir Wahab, Afghan-American professor, speaking to us from Portland, Oregon. When we come back, we speak to Ari Berman about the latest Republican attacks on voting rights, the voter suppression laws that are being passed in state after state in this country. Stay with us. Succumbs to the loneliness of time by Voices of Afghanistan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we end today's show looking at the extreme voting restrictions advancing in a number of Republican-led states here in the United States. On Thursday, Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a sweeping voter suppression law that will make it harder to vote by mail, limit ballot drop boxes, impose new voter ID requirements, and criminalize giving food and water to voters waiting in long lines at polling places. Governor DeSantis signed the bill in a private ceremony broadcast on Fox and Friends after a spokesperson barred other reporters, telling one the event was a Fox News exclusive. DeSantis was surrounded by a group of Republican lawmakers, none of them African American.
Right now, I have what we think is the strongest election integrity measures in the country. I'm actually going to sign it right here. It's going to take effect. So
there you go.
Bill is signed.
Comes as the Texas House of Representatives passed a Republican-backed voter suppression bill around 3 a.m. Friday morning. After an all-night session, Republican Governor Greg Abbott's expected to sign the measure after it's reconciled with the Texas Senate voter suppression bill. Meanwhile, Republicans in Ohio have introduced a bill to put severe restrictions on ballot drop boxes and absentee voting. At the federal level, the sweeping voting rights and election overhaul bill, known as the For the People Act, goes before the Senate's Democratic-controlled Rules Committee Tuesday, where it faces changes aimed at winning support from the lone Democratic holdout Senator Joe Manchin and Republicans. For more, we're joined by Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman, whose article in the March-April issue of the magazine is headlined, "The Insurrection Was Put Down, the GOP Plan for Minority Rule Marches On." Ari, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, describe what happened in Florida, then go to Texas and talk about what these voter suppression laws have at their core and the details.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me back. Well, first off, the Florida law really is a copycat of the Georgia voter suppression law. It does a lot of things that the Georgia law did. It bans drop boxes or severely restricts them. It makes it a crime to give people food and water, makes it harder to get absentee ballots. It expands access for partisan poll watchers to observe ballot counting. It was signed, as you mentioned, as a Fox News exclusive, something I've never seen before, where the press and the public, by extension, were shut out, an example of democracy dying in the dark in the so-called Sunshine State. And then you go to Texas, another state where democracy is dying in the dark, because they literally passed a voter suppression bill at 3 a.m. that will criminalize efforts to make it easier to vote while legalize voter intimidation. And I say that because it criminalizes efforts to make it easier to vote, because if election officials, for example, will send out absentee ballot request forms to voters who don't request them, which is a standard thing in lots of states, they can now be charged with a criminal offense. At the same time, if election officials try to remove partisan poll watchers who might be trying to intimidate voters, they could themselves be charged with a criminal offense. So basically what it's trying to do is legalize voter suppression. I think at the core, the Florida bill, the Texas bill, all of these bills, they are trying to weaponize the big lie that Trump told that the election was stolen. They're trying to make it harder for Democratic constituencies to be able to vote in future elections. And they are trying to institutionalize voter suppression in a way that they couldn't do in 2020. They were unable to overturn the election through litigation and intimidation in 2020. So now they're trying to change the rules to get the same outcome in 2022 and 2024.
Ari Berman, can you talk about the Texas bill's statement of purpose, initially stating the measures designed to preserve the purity of the ballot box? Talk about the significance of that phrase.
That language about the purity of the ballot box is straight from the Jim Crow era. It was literally used to defend things like all-white primaries and to disenfranchise Black and Mexican-American voters in Texas and other states. And a Texas Democratic rep, Rafael Enchia, asked the bill's sponsor about this. He said, did you know that the phrase purity at the ballot box was used to disenfranchise African-Americans and Mexican-Americans in Texas and to justify Jim Crow? And the bill's sponsor, Briscoe Cain, who, by the way, traveled to Pennsylvania after the election to try to overturn the election results there, said that he wasn't aware that purity at the ballot box had been used to justify Jim Crow. That was either shockingly ignorant or knowingly obtuse. But either way, the fact that Texas Republicans put language into their bill that was ripped straight from Jim Crow gives you an idea of what they're trying to do with these voter suppression bills.
You've said the fact that GOP voter suppression efforts are still being described as partisan battle rather than an all-out assault on democracy is unconscionable. Talk about that. And also, if people aren't following what's happening in Arizona, the fourth counting by this ninja private company that's being paid a fortune by Arizona, some of those counting participated in the insurrection.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that every single day you see headlines that basically say Republicans try to protect election integrity and Democrats call it voter suppression. The media is still trying to do false equivalents in terms of how they cover voter suppression. The issue is not Democrats versus Republicans. The issue is Republicans versus democracy. They're making it harder for everybody to vote. And yes, this might fall harder on Democratic leading constituencies, but these are changes in Georgia and Florida and Texas that are going to affect millions of voters. So this is not about partisan politics. This is about one party having an all-out assault on democracy, on the democratic process. And I think that's how it should be covered. And if you look at Arizona, this is not a fourth counting of the votes. This is just a complete conspiratorial witch hunt where they are trying to manufacture claims of fraud in order to build support for overturning future elections. Remember, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in Arizona is dominated by Republicans. Every single member of that board is a Republican except for one Democrat. It was Republicans in Arizona that signed off on the election results. It was the Republican governor, the Republican attorney general, the Republican head of the Supreme Court. All of the people that signed off on the election results in Arizona were Republicans, but that's not enough for Republicans in the legislature. They are basically trying to weaponize the insurrection through this audit, which is not really an audit. It's an OCHA witch hunt, actually. And I think it's going to have very detrimental effects, not just in Arizona, but in other states. They're trying to export this audit now to other states. It's being led by someone that was a key member of the Stop the Steal movement. So it's very, very disturbing what's happening here. And my worry is that in so many different ways, the big lie is being weaponized, whether it's the audit in Arizona, whether it's the new voter suppression laws, whether it's the attempt to oust Liz Cheney and put in place someone that backed overturning the election results in her place. I think this is all connected in terms of the fact that the Republican Party is just waging an all-out war on democracy.
And finally, Ari, we just have less than a minute. The whole issue of the federal law, the For the People Act, H.R. 1. Explain its significance and where it stands.
So the For the People Act is going to pass the Senate Rules Committee on Tuesday. Then it will go to the Senate floor. It's a sweeping democracy reform bill that would put in place measures like automatic registration, election day registration, early voting, expanded mail voting in all 50 states. And I think it's more important than ever, given these voter suppression laws. It's going to be hard to challenge all of these laws in Florida, Texas, Georgia through the courts. And I think it makes federal legislation all the more important. And it's very clear that Democrats are either going to pass legislation to protect democracy, or the Republican Party is going to undermine the democratic process for the next decade and beyond at the state level.
Ari Berman, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your pieces. Reporter for Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And that does it for our broadcast. Again, if you want to sign up for our daily digest, get our news headlines and news alerts daily, you can send the word Democracy Now, one word without a space. You can text that to 66866. That's 66866. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, and the whole miraculous team that makes Democracy Now! Happen every day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.